Okay, you've got the handout here, and underneath you've got a page which is actually from an article by Pascal Boyer, Religious Thought and Behaviour as Byproducts of Brain Function, from an article called Trends in Cognitive Sciences. And I'll come back to that. A real example here of diagrams that are supposed to show you something about religious studies. If only we could do that. Can you imagine going into your exam and drawing a diagram of how religious belief works and that kind of positive confidence? We'll come back to what it's about. I love table one, do's and don'ts in the study of religion.
It's like primary school.
But what he's saying is interesting. What he's saying is interesting. But yeah, wouldn't it save time if instead of writing an essay in that hour in your exam, you could just like draw out a little table, tick, 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 cross, cross, cross.
That would be good.
Done. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So here are my caveats at the beginning. I'm not going to talk very much about current projects that are going on in research institutions around the world, like the Ian Ramsey Centre and elsewhere, mainly for reasons of space and time. There's quite a lot that is happening, you know, theological implications of genetic adaptation of character, chemical adaptation of mental health. What does that mean for theology? You know, if health and happiness are key issues that theology engages with, that religion engages with, what does it mean that we can do, we can chemically modify health and happiness? What does that mean for ethics? If we can make people good by administering something physically, then what does that mean for kind of deeper issues, if you like? And there's a lot of theological engagement with those kinds of questions. Extraordinary religious experiences, of course, you know, we talked about mysticism before, and that's a very big area to work on. And there's a huge debate that goes on in the psychology of religion over whether religious experience should be seen as continuous with normal everyday cognitive processes, whether it's something really special and different that needs its own methods of study because it's unique. And you do get both approaches. I think perhaps it's true to say that people are less fascinated with the idea that there's a unique and irreducible religious experience and have started to bring it back down to the realm of everyday cognitive processes, which actually goes back to Freud and people like this. Nor am I going to talk very much on religious belief as it's seen by, I think, really excellent work done by philosophers of religion, anthropologists of religion, people like D.Z. Phillips, Clifford Geertz, Wittgenstein, who kind of trespass into that territory of psychology of religion, religious belief, and I think often interact very intelligently with these other more explicitly psychological thinkers, but we'll leave them aside for now. And also, of course, other people who trespass into this area would be people who work on the formation of concepts, of symbols and of ideas, that from Rudolf Otto to Eliade to Levi-Strauss, all those people who also kind of are in a way are working in the sphere of the psychological. Lots of general issues that come up dealing with psychology of religion. And of course, in many ways, the biggest one is, can you explain religious belief without explaining it away? In some ways, the answer ought to be quite simple, I think. The answer ought to be that you can give an account of how beliefs work without saying that this is the only thing that goes on, without explaining it away. Can you give an account of where beliefs come from, how they're generated? That's the big question. It's the genetic question. It's the genesis of beliefs. Can you give an account of how they're generated without getting rid of any possible quote-unquote spiritual causes? Often there isn't a conflict, A, because the psychologist is saying, this is one of the ways that the belief happens. And you can then say, and there are some other ways that the belief happens as well. You know, it doesn't have to be only that. And I've just given a quote from Fraser Watts here, who kind of puts that point. He needs to put that point at the beginning of his book in order to sort of in a sense, justify what goes on in the rest of the book. But he says, when a psychological approach is taken to religious phenomena, it is not being suggested that they can be understood wholly in these terms. Most human phenomena have many different facets, can be described from many different points of view, and are the result of many different causal factors. Religious experience is in one sense such an inherently psychological phenomenon that religious writers over the centuries have necessarily used at least some kind of lay psychology in talking about it. I think that's one interesting, quite interesting point that he makes. The psychology of religion is always there. You know, we talk about Geertz and Phillips doing psychology of religion. Actually, if you look at Aquinas and his account of analogy and language and things like this, he's also doing, in a sense, psychology of religion. Augustine, in a sense, is full of the psychology of religion, a lot of it very autobiographical. So in a way, he's right to say that's always there. And that gives you maybe a platform for saying, now we're going to look at some modern models for how reasoning works, you know, cognition works, interpretation works, the fit of our ideas to our emotions works, our sense of deepest need, existential need, the relationship between physical needs and, if you like, more personal, psychological, social, emotional needs, how all of those different features of the mind work. At some level, that's one of the jobs of psychology of religion, where it totally intersects with all the other subjects. How do we think? We just need a better model of how we think. And actually, we don't have a very good model of how we think. Freud helps by giving us an idea of different levels and different dynamics. And he explained to us that we don't always know what we're thinking. We haven't got immediate transparency. And that's useful. But, you know, I'm not always clear that we've done that much since Freud to improve our idea. And we'll come back to some later ideas of people trying to improve this. A lot of work on emotion, for instance, has been highly neglected. So that ought to be fine and useful and helpful in all sorts of ways. it does, you know, leave the question of whether there can still be, quote unquote, a religious source of these ideas if you've given a psychological explanation of how they arise. And of course, I guess you could give a religious psychological explanation. You could say, which is what a lot of people do in some cases, you see God, and then these religious features come into action. And probably some people might want to say that. Although, of course, the trend has been for people to say, no, it doesn't start with you seeing God. It starts with some human natural experience from everyday life that then by some strange mechanism gets turned into religion. You know, and that, in a way, the contrast between those two positions shows how, when you come back to the beginning of the process, you know, is your hand forced? Do you have to say where you think the first origin of the idea comes from? It's a big issue. How could you do it otherwise? A lot of people who felt that they were crossing over the two disciplines in a fruitful way have said that, and this is very common in the study of religion, you can leave out the ultimate source of the religious experience. We can just bracket that off. In a way, Eliade does this. He says there's the sacred, but we won't talk about where it comes from that much. Otto, in a way, sets up the model for doing this, and they're all borrowing from Kant, by saying you have the experience, but then, this is the Kantian model, you have the experience, but immediately your own psychological, personal, you know, sort of subjective framework comes in and is imposed upon that experience, and as you receive it, you received it in a particular form that's specific to you or to humanity or what have you. So in a way, Kant's very useful. He shows you where the psychology is, but he doesn't refuse there being a source out there as well, a causal source. So, and a lot of people have kind of tried to adapt and adopt that. So for instance, some people will say that Jung is reductive, in the sense that he says ideas rise up, or in a sense, both instincts, ideas rise up from the unconscious and then take a form, a mythic form, a story form, an image form, and come to the conscious as an idea which you don't recognize its unconscious roots.
Yeah. Doesn't Jung kind of get less and less like that as he goes on and starts to... Mm. believe that the stuff that rises up actually exists in some sense?
Yeah, I mean, the sense in which it actually exists is very ambiguous, I think. And he certainly gets he is quite realist about it. I've mentioned Victor White, who was a Dominican, who wrote an article on religion and Catholic theology and sent it to Jung, and Jung read it and liked it, and they carried on this interaction. Over the years, they argued. Eventually, they argued and felt that they didn't quite go together. Jung thought that he was religious enough, that he basically thought the ideas from the unconscious could be seen as ultimately springing from either some deep impulse in humanity, which was itself, you know, in a sense, divine, very much, you know, deep down there is something which is the divine working within you, and it's a manifestation of this. Or, you know, in theory, if you wanted, you could say that those are ways that we have appropriated at an unconscious level the divine out there. So either way, he's kind of leaving space for a realist object outside. And he thought that was enough. But when Victor White, who's very excited about how Jungian sort of psychology is going to help Catholic theology understand itself, when White really gets into it with him, he says, no, this isn't right, because everything, for you, he says, everything ultimately, in some senses, it seems to be a metaphor. And it means that the propositions, the ideas, never quite get to be true. They're always reflecting some inner, sort of almost existential force within humanity. And you could say it's not just within humanity. Jung, of course, has this idea not only of the consciousness and the unconscious level where all these different forces, you know, swirl about and take form, but he also has this idea of the collective unconscious, that in a way is him saying that these deep issues aren't just subjective parts of the human mind and experience. They're somehow issues that are there in the world as a whole. He gets rather mystical and mysterious about it. But what he doesn't do very well is actually engage with Victor White's idea that, yes, but as well as Christ being a good idea, Bultmann-esque, you know, Jung fits quite well with Bultmann. He fits quite well with that whole German interpretative Lutheran hermeneutic tradition. But he says, as well as it, Jesus being a good idea, he said, I actually think he's also true. You know, and at first, you know, Jung would go, yes, yes, of course he's true. Yes, yes, true for you. That's wonderful. He illuminates your life. And somewhere down the line, of course, eventually White kind of goes, wait a second. When you smile and say, yes, yes, of course it's true, what you really mean is, they're there, dear man. Yes, of course he helps your life.
Yeah. You know that interview where he said, well, someone on the BBC said, do you believe in God? And he said, no, I know. And then just...
Yeah, left. Well, of course, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think Jung's religiosity itself is really fascinating. And somewhere there's an even more explicit statement of exactly the same thing, where he says, you know, people have asked me, do I believe in God? And I feel like it's not a question I even can or need to answer. He says it's the most immediate, obvious, and certain thing in my life. You know, he's a very religious man. But one of the things that happens when he engages with, if you like, people within a sort of particular theological perspective, to him there's an underlying thing that happens at sort of an existential level, at a deep psychological level, and it takes all kinds of forms and ideas and doctrines and propositions, but nothing propositional, nothing that, you know, says something definitely directly and says it's true, is ever going to really be able to have truth value in that old-fashioned way. You know, it all has truth value in the sense of it being useful, fruitful. William James says something similar. You can argue they're not quite the same, but William James is the first pragmatist in many respects. He writes Varieties of Religious Experience, and he says explicitly in that, truth means what is useful. Truth means what helps and illuminates your life. You know, and in that sense, he's expressing actually what people like Bultmann and a lot of, you know, he's very much, all of these people are channeling the existentialists, they're channeling the German debate on phenomenology and whether truth is out there or ultimately in here and concerned with human issues. And they've all decided to look at truth as something that engages with our deep human concerns. That fits really well with Jung. But if someone then wants to say, yes, yes, it's true for me, it illuminates me, but it's also true, then you get into trouble. And the relationship with Victor White and Jung, though it didn't get really bitter, didn't quite work out. And there's a nice letter from Jung to the sister who was taking care of Victor White when he was dying. saying, oh, I'm very sorry, I can't see him. I had cherished the hope that he would carry on the magnum opus for me after I was gone, but I see that I was wrong. You know, this hope that this you know, Catholic monk would take on the work, but of course, you know, A, Victor White dies, and B, he's not quite convinced. You know, from a definitely theological perspective. So it does raise those issues though. Yeah.
So if these psychologists say, well, truth is just what helps and what
mm-hmm.
what works, I mean, then they can't exempt themselves from that, can they? I mean, they
yeah.
are in a way imposing two
yeah.
kinds of truths, you know, one religious
yeah.
truth and one scientific truth.
But in some ways, I think that, you know, after people like, you know, people always mention Kuhn and Firebend and their idea that what science is doing isn't truth either, they're just producing useful models. So in a way, they are following their own theory. They're not saying, we're telling the truth, but you religious people are coming up with metaphors that are useful. In a way, they're saying, here's a metaphor that's useful. And then they, you know, proceed to talk about other useful metaphors. Let me push on. Gosh, we get through the time so quickly. So those kinds of issues arise and still need to be worked out really comprehensively and well. That the problem of explanation and reduction, the problem of interpretation, the problem, whether it's interpretation of brain states or interpretation of people's descriptions of their inner life, is a big problem. And of course, the problem of typologies. People tend to classify religious experience, very much like Ninian Smart producing these seven dimensions of religion. Similarly, they'll produce these typologies, these classifications, that sometimes you think, wait a second, where did this come from? And this is making huge assumptions. And they'll be of all different sorts. You know, Pascal Boyer says, some religious experience is high sensory states. Another religious experience is repetitive lessons. You know, suddenly you have this intense experience, or you do a ritual every day. And he makes that distinction, and that's fine, and that's useful, of course. But then if you go ahead straight away and do research based on that, you start to think, well, that was just a model he put forward. Now he's acting as if it's true. Maybe that, you know, if you remember that that's all they're doing, putting forward models, it's okay. But sometimes you think, he hasn't really sort of covered this well. There's a great study. If you look at the book by Michael Argyle, which is called, I think, Psychology and Religion, and he did a lot of work here in Oxford for this book, interacting with Ian Ramsey Center and elsewhere. He gives a good kind of survey of this social psychological approach, gathering data, where indeed you do most of the time have to make assumptions at the beginning in order to even do any questioning and get any data. And as you read it, it's interesting because it both says lots of things that look quite grand and impressive, but also it immediately makes you think, wait a second, where did that come from? And if you're a religious studies scholar, of course, often you'll think, wait a second, that's just Christianity. and you get things like, see, I have examples. They did studies where they ended up categorizing religious experience in terms of its content. For instance, they give you the same box-ticking thing. How was your religious experience? Question mark. Did it involve, colon, peace, you know, the box, you know, to tick if you get that, peace, a feeling of optimism, love, a sense of joy, a feeling of understanding the world, a sense of unity, a feeling of profound solitude, a fresh outlook on life, an image of light, a physical sensation of warmth, a feeling that you would never be able to describe it. You know, and you can sort of sit there and go, mine had, it had peace, but not optimism, you know, tick. It's an interesting process in itself to have to do it. And it's interesting, actually, you know, in some ways I think it's even more interesting to think about what it means to try and put that list down there and what happens when people try and answer it. You know, how much it tells you. It tells you something about people's, at least their perception of their religious life. How much it doesn't tell you is also a big question. It's kind of fun. You know, there's another one that was done in terms of the triggers for people's religious experiences, and you can find these online. As a study done by Greeley, someone called Greeley, in 1975. He did a sample of 1,467 people in the States. He found that 35% of them had had religious experiences. Greeley, G-R-E-E-L-E-Y. And he kind of, he gives them these questionnaires, and then he put down percentages. And so, for instance, when he asked them what triggered their religious experience, he got in this order, a few other things, but mostly in this order, listening to music, I think, was number one. Prayer, I think, was number two. Nature, is it going around in nature? Tick. Is it quiet reflection by yourself? Tick. Is it going to worship in church? Is it, you know, watching young children?
Yeah, I was going to say, there's looking at kids, isn't it?
At kids is quite a bizarre one. You wonder, A, not only how many people have a spiritual experience when they're sitting in the playground, you know, a whole different perspective on those guys who sit in the playground and watch kids, you know. Like, no, it's okay, he's not a dodgy old guy. He's having a spiritual experience. Like, oh, yeah, okay. But it also makes you think, so why did they put it in there? Where were they coming from that at the outset, you know, they... Or, of course, often what you might then do
is...
Well,
lots of people say, I have kids, and there's the wonder of birth.
Oh, yeah, maybe it was a... Yeah.
And people say it's like, this is the biggest...
You're seeing a small child.
The way it's presented sounds like it's in a playground. It's just like, when you see children being happy, and you think...
Yeah, I mean, so this is the thing, you know, and again, you look at the thing and you think, how far are you predetermining what the answer is going to be? When you're in a playground watching beautiful children frolic in the golden sunlight, do you feel, you know, tick, you know, a feeling of intense joy, or B, a feeling of, you know, cruelty and misery? Oh, clearly.
Our reaction to that in 2007 may be different than it was in 1975.
I think that's probably true as well. You know, and of course, what may have been the case was that they will have done a pre-test, as it were, and gone around and did lots of interviews and asked people what kind of things, so that they knew what kind of things to look for. But of course, that always raises the circular problem that your pre-test determines what you're going to look for. So if you've missed out the whatever 17 people who have religious experiences when they, I don't know, go clubbing, then they just won't make it into your sample. You know, all these kind of problems of where you get the ideas from come in.
Did he not put some... Well, normally you get into the questionnaire, you would say, is there anything that was not mentioned in the questionnaire that you'd like to mention?
Yeah,
Maybe that was more of a 1990s methodology.
I don't know. I mean, possibly they did put it in, but of course, almost by definition, that won't make it into your statistics. Because it would... Exactly, yeah. It would work if you then want to do a second study. But often, you know, this is the problem. By the time you've read through the other stuff, it's already determined the way people are thinking. So they're already thinking within that kind of thing. Whereas if you then ask them completely separately, and we're talking, I mean, literally raising different images, speaking to them in a different way, in a different place, where, you know, people's discourse and their thought changes so much according to who they're talking to and where they are. You might get really different answers.
Also, when you have an experience like that, normally you're, for a better word, your consciousness has some profoundness to it when you're having that experience.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
If you're in a common expression of thought, you're not going to access maybe the language or the parameters of thought that will explain those things which you've written.
And they just
explain.
Have to say, and then... That covers up a huge...
It covers everything. Yeah, that's right. That's the one kid who hasn't got much time to fill out the form. He's like, definitely ineffable. Okay, bye, I'm going to go now.
Actually, everything's pretty much ineffable.
I mean, so, you know, and again, then maybe people end up saying, tick the word that seems most... most easily associated with your experience. And again, you know, I'm making fun of the wooliness of it. Of course, in some ways, that's quite valid. You know, and in some ways, if you ask me about, you know, my walk and say, well, was it exciting or was it tranquil, I'd probably choose one or the other. You know, oh, I just went, you know, rock climbing, I just went kickboxing. Okay, which word fits that most? Was it exhilarating? Was it calming? You know, I'd say, well, I guess it's probably more on the exhilarating side. And that's fair. That's a fair thing to say. You know, in a way, the hard part, perhaps the onus is not on the psychologist on whether or not he's produced this work. The hard part is for us, in interpreting it in a really intelligent way that takes account of all the vagueness, all the interpretative problems. You know, sometimes it could be useful where you'll say, you read people's descriptions of their experience and you'll say, well, that doesn't give me that accurate an idea of what their experience was. But it does give me an interesting idea of how they themselves would describe their experience, indeed, to a kind of an objective authority figure. And you can then look at how and why that happens.
Maybe it's just if you... I did a course once on, like, you know, anthropological research and what you have to do. And then you have to find indicators. And the indicators here, you know, feelings, describing your feelings is maybe not the right thing. Maybe you should go for hard facts when it comes to indicators. You know, did you faint? Did you... I don't know. You know, did you... Whatever. Did something happen? You know what I mean? Rather than going for a description of feelings.
But how many times would you have facts, people stating facts? How many times would you have emotions and feelings? There would be many who would be able to, you know, compare that in that sense.
It almost suggests that you want... Of course, it's hard to do these kinds of studies. And one of the problems is once you've done one set of interviews, you've already prejudged people about how they're going to come back and answer the others. But maybe we need, you know, lots of different lights being shone on it to do with, you know, physical response, to do with, you know, everyday language. Maybe you need someone asking them in a sort of a sciencey way, and you need someone asking them in a kind of a everyday sort of way, and you need to get all these different things and to actually bring them together, and that would help solve this deep problem that you get recurring in the psychology of religion, where it also often seems as if you're only hitting one level. So there are issues about that. I'm going to move on because I actually don't want to mainly talk about those people. We've only got 10 minutes. But I mean, they are interesting, and to be fair as well, I think when I've talked to people in the area, there are very complex mechanisms in place for analysing data. You know, data analysis isn't a simple thing, and people work very hard at, you know, all sorts of things, looking at use of language, looking at response while they're answering, all sorts of things. So it is an interesting area, and maybe the reluctance to engage with it too much is fear of how much work would be involved in trying to solve the problems. You know, which doesn't mean to say that they can't be actually solved. Well, I just want to sort of briefly mention the work of some of the other people who've gone ahead and produced models and said interesting things about psychology that could be fruitful for the study of religion. After Jung, I've called these people the expressivists in a sense. Jung kind of wants to say that there's something happening in the person that gets expressed outwards, projected in religion. So in a sense, religion isn't necessarily a mistake, as people like Freud think it is in many senses. It's an expression of an inner life. And of course, one of the problems with his work is that he's very much concerned with religion and psychology, both as healing sciences. He feels, in a sense, he feels like they're both applied. They're both there to try and help you. And of course, he explicitly, in the essay Modern Man in Search of a Soul, he's very positive about comparative religion and world religion, because he thinks, and this fits with his ideas, that whatever you grow up with builds up part of your psyche and part of your existential needs. But by definition, it will always leave out some stuff that's on the other side of the scale. You know, your religion emphasizes love, but maybe it hasn't emphasized other parts of life that are harder and more difficult to deal with. You know, famously, he said that the God of Christianity was so good that he cast a shadow, and that shadow was the devil, was that undealt with side of things. We just had Halloween, and that's very fitting for that kind of idea. And similarly, you know, he thought then that each religion could go elsewhere and get those sides of its personality, as it were, strengthened in turn. And it was a very positive healing process. He wrote, in fact, healing may be called a religious problem. And in the essay, I don't know what it's called, Clergy, was it Psychotherapists or the Clergy, I think it's called. It's in the same collection as Modern Man in Search of a Soul. He explicitly says, as a psychologist, I have to deal with people who need to be healed, and I have to deal with them in a way that is really very much like the clergy. He writes,
this is
This is Jung, yeah, and he writes in Modern Man in Search of a Soul, among all my patients in the second half of life, that is to say, over 35, there has not been one whose problem in the last resort was not that of finding a religious outlook on life. And he kind of calls for the clergy and the psychologists, the psychotherapists to come together and to address this common project of sorting people out. And in some ways, I think he reflects an idea that's quite widespread, and you'll find other psychologists and anthropologists are often, in a way, quietly channeling existentialism, channeling people who say that ultimately our big problems are the existential problems of life, death, what to do with life, what makes sense of life, and how to find that and engage it and make it part of our everyday activity. In a way, he wants to set the problem of happiness, or happiness fulfillment, satisfaction, as the single overriding science into which all of these things fit. It's kind of interesting in itself. Now, one of the people who've carried on his project is Joseph Campbell. I won't say a lot about him because while he's really interesting to read, of course, he's a best-selling author between the 50s and the 80s, really, an American writer who had done some work on Jungian psychology and kind of appropriated it very much in the practical sense to say that myths and archetypes are out there as expressions of our inner life. And what happens is we get alienated from our inner life. We don't realize what's going on underneath. So by engaging with these myths and stories and religious ideas, they almost act like your therapist. They're like the Rorschach blots. You see in them the things that are happening in your inner world. And by making those inner issues external, you're actually able to deal with them. You know, again, this idea that our inner world is not accessible to us. And that therefore you need mechanisms that will bring your inner world out so that you can then put it on the table and sort it out or get catharsis in some way. Very strong idea of bringing the inside outside.
So did people buy this and kind of apply this?
Oh, people loved it. Joseph Campbell was very popular, especially in the States. He had a whole TV series which was very popular called The Power of Myth. And the first time I heard of it was my family in the States said, oh, you've got to see this. It's really exciting. You know, it's really... and in some ways it captures the...
Is it on the internet?
Might be downloadable. It was very popular at the time. And he himself was influenced by literature. It's very a bit like Fraser. You know, he didn't worry too much about methodological issues, to be honest, but he thought it was all fruitful and interesting and that the other cultures could tell us a lot about ourselves. And interestingly, he thought that there was a continuum between religion and art. So you can go to the religions, but also if you don't fancy that, you can go to the art gallery. And those are also external expressions of inner processes. And similarly, you can kind of find yourself psychologically in those as well. He's influenced by Finnegan's Wake. He wrote on James Joyce's book, Finnegan's Wake, and also by Thomas Mann's Joseph and His Brothers. Now, he left open the idea that all of this could be realistic. It could be they're just poetic expressions of an inner life, and that inner life actually, in the end, he says, you know, does relate to some divine other object. So he kind of also left that possibility of a truth value open.
So he did say there's an inner life, but also...
He said there's an inner life.
And like a transcendent thing, and he didn't...
Yeah. He didn't talk about it very much, but there are interviews where he says, oh yes, and all of this world of the inner life is our response to the transcendent. Again, in that very much Rudolf Otto, almost Kantian kind of way, that idea is very strong. 3 minutes left. So on the other side, we've got two of the people I want to talk about most and just flag them up. I've called the Freudian heritage kind of the mechanistic side, in the sense that Fraser, Freud, Durkheim, Feuerbach, Berger, Marx, all of those people, in a way, are looking at for some kind of mechanism by which something that is not religion is turned into religion. With Fraser, that will be your need to deal with practical physical issues, like getting enough food. And then by a process of being confused about how the world works, you produce some magical science of trying to make the rain gods come, and that turns into religion. In Freud, it'll be there are inner processes that need to be dealt with, and in fact, because you can't accept them, they get projected outwards and turned into religion. But again, it's something that isn't religion by some mechanism of the brain. Bing, it goes outside and it becomes not becomes religion. Now, obviously, that is an issue in terms of, you know, reduction of religion into something else. And a lot of them fall into this. One of the problems with it can be they universalize. So, for instance, Freud says the Oedipus complex is there everywhere. And he's looked at some quote-unquote savage societies. And even Malinowski, who was very, you know, very negative about the savages in many ways, in his study, Sex and Repression in Savage Society, showed that the Oedipus complex is not universal across all cultures. It's a pretty early text, early 20th century. But even he said, we can't just use these little mechanisms and assume that they're true for everybody all across the world. And also they tend to assume that something simple, a simple mechanism, will explain more complex ideas. And that's not always the case. Sometimes explanation is also complex. Well, in clinical psychology, R.D. Lang explored repression, like Freud. He looked a lot at schizophrenia. His book is called The Divided Self. But he also was very Jungian in saying that the whole science of psychology should be dissolved into a wider science, he cites Sartre, of improving the biography of the person as a whole. He questioned normality, and he said maybe those who are mad or those who are religious believers, while it doesn't seem to fit with the normal, he says, what is the normal? You know, the normal is a strange construct in itself. He actually has a bit where he says, you know, maybe these people who have a different perception of the world are able to let in truths and ideas that the normal people don't. It doesn't mean that they're wrong. And he has this interesting quote, our civilization represses not only the instincts, not only sexuality, but any form of transcendence. So he links the Freudian idea of sexuality to transcendence. He makes this jump. It is not surprising that someone with an insistent experience of other dimensions that he cannot entirely deny or forget will run the risk of being either destroyed by the others or of being betrayed by what he knows. He says, I would wish to emphasize that our normal adjusted state is too often the abdication of ecstasy, the betrayal of our true potentialities. And it's interesting to read his Divided Self. It's very eloquently written, and it's very interested in, you know, not the religious person as being like the crazy person. You know, they're both beyond the normal. They have to get normal. But as actually being like the crazy person in that they've both explored a new territory that other people don't get into very much. And I think that's potentially quite fruitful. On the other side, and this just to end, this takes you to the other handout. Pascal Boyer, in The Naturalness of Religious Ideas, Religion Explained, looks into what he calls intuitive ontologies. So he does a lot of study on how we, very much the kind of developmental psychology has been very influential, like Jean Piaget, on how we learn to actually perceive the world. You know, we learn solid object, we learn active human being, we learn all these categories. And he says, like Geertz, he wanted to look at religious ideas in terms of how we acquire them, why they appeal. And he says that ideas that actually are acquired, that people like in society and pass on in society, are the ones that A, reflect our intuitive ideologies, they're normal enough to our idea of the world that they make sense, but B, are novel, are different, challenge, subvert, say something crazy about our intuitive ideologies, ontologies, in such a way that that novelty value gives it, you know, excitement, meaning, and makes it popular. He says those are the ideas that work. And that's why you get in this wonderful diagram of his, person is the intuitive ideology, and counterintuitive physics. So he says a person is a physical object. And then you get this person going, I saw a ghost enter the room through the wall. And you see he's put 5 exclamation marks. You know, you've taken the idea of a person and counterintuitively subverted it. Or person as biology, biological being that is born and dies. He says, subvert that. And someone goes, did you know that your spirit never dies? 5 exclamation marks again. Or an object, an artifact, which is not animate and has no agency. And he says, no, it's not passive and inanimate. This statue will listen to your prayers. 5 exclamation marks. He wants to show he's taken something, you know, religion takes something normal and does something funny with it. And actually ends up reinterpreting religious ideas from that perspective. Very interesting ideas, I think. And I won't go into it too much. I'll just read out this last quote as you guys, if you need to go, then go ahead, I apologize. He writes, "Theology's explicit dogmas, scholarly interpretations of religion, cannot be taken as a reliable description of either the contents or the causes of people's beliefs. Religious notions are products of the supernatural imagination, and supernatural concepts are informed by very general assumptions from domain concepts like person, living thing, man-made object. These notions are salient and inferentially productive because they combine specific features that violate some default expectations for the domain, it's like things that are normal, with expectations held by default as true of the entire domain. It's features that violate the domain, so the unusual bits, and also things that fit with what we know. Bye, guys. See you next week." Pretty much at the end, anyway. It's interesting, partly, to look at Boyer because he really has taken a biological, neurological study mixed with developmental psychological observation. So he's looked at how the brain works and seems to categorize things. And he has pictures of the brain in his articles and the different parts of it. And he's looked at how that seems to map onto knowledge acquisition in young people and as you grow older. And he's looked at how all of those structures which seem to be intrinsic in the brain can be used to understand how certain ideas are popular or unpopular, fit or don't fit with our general picture of things. So he really says quite clearly that he sees religion is a probable, although no means inevitable, byproduct of the normal operation of human cognition. It's just a set of special ideas that are exciting and kind of fit with how we do knowledge in general.
Is there any application of, like, game theory? Like, a lot of research.
Yeah.
I was interested in that for a while, on
yeah.
how people play and why.
Yeah.
Or how even...
Hmm.
I don't know, fish play, you know, all sorts of beings play.
Yeah.
It's like kind of useless behavior.
Yeah.
It's when they have a bit of time on their hands, you know, relax, then they just play and do things, and that's how sort of they create things.
I think it would be interesting. I mean, people not in psychology of religion got excited from an anthropological perspective by a book called Homo Ludens by Huizinga.
Yeah,
yeah, this
yeah,
kind of, you know, study
really
of play. But I don't think very much has been done on it in respect... I don't know how much has been done on it in psychology just in respect of knowledge creation.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think much has been done on it from a religious perspective. It'd be really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things, I think, potentially are really interesting ways to look at how, you know, Otto and Eliade and all these people we accept want to talk about the formation of religious concepts, but they don't really do very much detailed work on it. So you could look at these psychologists and come up with much better models. And just one last model I want to mention, you know, other tools that could be useful. Recently, something called the study of emotional intelligence, EI, has become quite popular. There's the idea that there's your rational intelligence, but more and more also in philosophy, people are starting to wonder about emotion, how we can do emotion, how we can understand emotion. It's the part of the mind that's been completely ignored, almost solely because, it's not quite true, but it's almost solely because, you know, whatever, in 400 BC, Plato says that the passions are just the horses that pull the chariot. It's reason that is the person inside the chariot, right? And so people have ignored the passions, almost as if the stuff in your head was only reason. And the emotions were just some weird extra thing. Now, some psychologists will say, yes, that's in fact, that is just your glands, it's just your chemicals, it's your hormones. But of course, in many respects, it's right to say that emotions are part of what are the contents of the psyche. So people started to try and look into that. Fraser Watts has done a little bit on this. John Bowker has done a little bit on this.
Are they saying that we should look at the emotions rather than... rather than the ratio, or we should see it all as an emotional thing?
I think most people will say that you shouldn't ignore the rational side. You know, that would be foolish as well. But the idea that we need to complement the rational model of mind with a really good understanding of emotion, and of course in religion that seems terribly important.
So the latest research on you know, heuristics and decision making shows that there is actually no rational side to it. at all.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know,
but then you want to redefine,
like, research on how do you make decisions. You know, your child is about to die. You know, which hospital do you go to, or even you've got judges who are, you know, supposed to employ rational thought, and they show that it just doesn't happen. You don't make rational versus emotional choices, because most of the time you can't compare things.
Yeah. I mean, briefly to go into it, part of what that kind of thing raises the issue of is how should we be actually categorizing the different parts of intelligence?
It's,
you know, it's not that there isn't such a thing as rationality. What it means is that we have different kinds of thinking, and one of them may be, you know, there is such a thing as logic, and logic sometimes comes into our thinking and sometimes doesn't. There is such a thing as, you know, imagination, imagining a scenario, playing it through in your mind, and then using a what-if idea. Boyer writes on that a little bit. Actually, a lot of our reasoning happens that way. It's not logical. You just imagine being in that situation and figuring out what feels like it would make sense. Other things will be immediately emotion-driven. Other things will be instinctive in some other way. So there are all these different sides that need to be kind of brought out. And hopefully people will do that. Someone developed... Goldman wrote a best-selling book on emotional intelligence that was rather dodgy in some ways. You know, you have to learn to be emotionally intelligent, and then he tried to apply it to like businesses that wanted to hire employees who didn't have just a high IQ but had a high EIQ as well, you know. But the idea of paying attention to emotion as well is quite an interesting idea. So I'm going to stop there because it's 10 past. But I think it's right to look at all the really interesting work done in psychology of religion as providing many different models and tools that could be really illuminating without necessarily, you know, that only works if you take on the idea that you can take a bit of their theory, but not all of their theory, you know. But I don't see why that's a problem necessarily. You still get writers who'll say, oh, well, Jung has this interesting point, but quite frankly, he believes this, and I don't agree with that, so we get rid of Jung. It's like people who say that Eliade must be wrong because he's necessarily... you know, a realist or necessarily whatever. I don't think that that's necessarily true. What we do is we take bits of stuff. In that way, I think study of religion is like, you know, parts of philosophy of religion, subjects where you draw on models and ideas to help you explain things. And in that respect, psychology is very fruitful and exciting. And if you can produce a table with do's and don'ts in the study of religion, do not say religion answers people metaphysical questions, but do say... religious thoughts are typically activated when people deal with concrete situations like crops, disease, birth, and a dead body. It's great. So, okay. I will see you guys hopefully next week.